Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. Today we do Mythbusters, and the co-host is Chris Rossini. Chris, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Paul. Great to be with you.
Very good. What do we have in store for our viewers today?
Well, we're going to cover a topic that's very misunderstood, and hopefully we could clear some things up, and that's infrastructure spending by the federal government. President Trump, when he was campaigning, pushed that he was going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. I'm going to read a quote for him, from him, and he said, "We're going to fix our inner cities and rebuild our highways, bridges, tunnels, airports, schools, hospitals. We're going to rebuild our infrastructure, which will become, by the way, second to none. And we will put millions of our people to work to rebuild it." Now, Dr. Paul, we're going to start with the obvious question. Where does a government that's $20 trillion in debt get the audacity to spend another trillion that doesn't have?
And the American people would say, why do you care? We don't have to care about that. Everybody gets finances. The government will take care of it. And, you know, I think this suggestion by Trump, and I'm sure he still believes in what he had said in the campaign, is pure Keynesianism. You know, if government spends the money and stimulates on infrastructure, but that's been around for a long time, the American system, you know, all the way back to the beginning of our history, there was a group of people that always did this. Hamilton believed in this type of thing, stimulate the economy. And Lincoln believed in the same thing. So this is a continuation. Now, with the economy never having fully recovered from the Great Recession, people are saying, what can we do? They can't just say, oh, well, follow Bernanke. He got us out of this mess. He just needs a little bit more Bernanke monetary policy. Print more money, buy more bonds. But so far, people are admitting that that's not working all that well. So, and the Fed and the monetary people, they don't want to take the same. Well, we did our part. Now it's up to Congress. They need to spend some money, pump it in, whether it's welfareism or corporate cronyism or whatever. But it's up to the Congress to spend more money. So that's part of this philosophy behind this. And it's probably true. There are some highways that need worked on, and it should be done. But the big question is it the proper function of the government to decide to stimulate the economy? We need to spend $1 trillion. And with a huge debt and deficit, which continues, which will continue because they're not giving up anything. It's sort of what kind of talk do you hear when they talk about cutting taxes? They say, well, who's going to pay for it? And they always want to tax somebody else. They never talk about paying for something by cutting spending. In this case, they're not going to worry about who's paying for it. But how does this come about? And the question is, where do they get this money? They can't just, say, well, we're going to raise your taxes $1 trillion next year. People would panic. The markets would crash. And you just can't say that. They have to continue with this fraud of saying, well, the government's going to do it. And what they don't want to be out front on is they're not going to raise the taxes. They will continue to borrow, but there's a limit to borrowing because right now the Fed does all the borrowing. If we just had the market loaning the government all this money to run the welfare warfare state, interest rates would be too high. So they have to have this other gimmick, and it's called monetary policy. So the Fed doesn't duck the responsibility, even if the emphasis is on infrastructure, spending more money on infrastructure, because ultimately the bill goes to the Fed. And they're very powerful. They have control of the money supply. They're the greatest counterfeiters in the history of mankind. So whatever it is, whether it's a trillion here or a trillion there, it never seems to add up to very much until the whole collapse comes, which that they're working on, and it may come sooner than most people believe, because they're not going to cut back on spending. Just like this is the answer by a conservative Republican administration, a Republican Congress, and they're arguing the case for more spending. Certainly, they don't even suggest less spending on the military or on welfareism, but it sounds a little bit better. We're going to create jobs. This is a sort of Keynesianism of producing jobs and in order to stimulate the economy. It's pure fiction. They will not accomplish what they hope to accomplish by doing this.
Yes, next I'm going to read a quote from our friend David Stockman. And he said, quote, Washington's primary job is maintenance of the interstate highway system. And that's in pretty good shape. Indeed, the reason we have state, county, municipal, and township governments in the U.S. is to take care of 99% of the road surfaces. So is Stockman correct that this should be a local and state matter?
Yeah, it should be. But they've been arguing over that for a long time from the very beginning. Even Jefferson had an argument about this. Even just the notion of posting the roads would lead to a lot of trouble, and it has. And it was well understood over our history that even posting roads didn't mean the federal government was in charge of building all our roads. The big change came in the 1950s after World War II when Eisenhower had the interstate highway program, which seemed like a brilliant idea. And people would say, well, don't you like the interstate highways? It's a good system, and we all use it. But it doesn't mean that if we didn't have the government doing it, that it wouldn't have happened. You know, it could have happened anyway. But it's very, very expensive, and it's very much controlled by the lobbyists. It's very much of an intervention, stimulatory program. But I think Stockman's statement is that if you need more money for keeping up the highways, he says they're in pretty good shape because local people do what they're responsible for, and they do keep up the local highways. So this is something that people have been wondering about for a long time. But when Eisenhower finally got this program going, what he did, he was even aware of the Constitution. He says, you know, we have to have a constitutional justification for this interstate program. And he said it was for national security purposes. We've heard that before. You know, everything we do everywhere, all the money we spend overseas, all the war, national security, which is pure fabrication, a total fiction. So the interstate highway system was built in case we had to move a lot of military troops in and out of the highway. Well, maybe the Department of Homeland Security are very happy because they sure have a lot of troops in our country today, and they keep preparing for disturbances in this country. So they may be justified in that sense that they need it for military reasons. But it is a terrible system. It's one of the things where it's cronyism at its worst. I keep arguing if you had to have an interim program, what you could do is you could have one office with about two or three people. If you collected the federal gasoline tax, just take it and say, well, Texas put this much in, New York put this much in, and write them a check and let them build the highways and accomplish that as an interim. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. It's going to continue, and there probably will be some program like this, but it's not going to solve the problem. The highway system could be handled in many different ways. I remember, you know, having lived in Pennsylvania when the Turnpike was started, I think it was late 30s, early 40s, it was almost privately developed. The government was involved to a degree, but none of the funding, nobody went to the federal government and say, we need a Pennsylvania Turnpike. They issued private bonds. So if you liked the idea, if you're a businessman or an individual, say, hey, this sounds like a good idea. They're going to cause a, create a fee for driving on the highway. It was very, very financially successful. The bonds always got paid off. It was so successful, the government decided they wanted to take over. But of course, now it's a boondoggle, and the people who put the money in don't necessarily get the benefits, and it's a real mess. So a lot of people just really get terrified with libertarians who say we ought to privatize the highways. Well, it's a long way to go before we're privatizing every single thing. There are transition. There's a lot of private roads already when you think about private developments and local communities and states could have a responsibility. But right now, it is truly a boondoggle. But when it's dealt with as an economic stimulus in a Keynesian fashion, it's even worse because it doesn't accomplish that, because usually they have to take the money from somewhere else, or they contribute to the problem of more inflation.
Next, we're going to cover a big area of this, and that's cronyism and waste. I'm sure crony corporations out there, when they hear $1 trillion, there's just dollar signs are in their eyes to get at that money. But please, Dr. Paul, tell us the story about, and this is from way back, of James J. Hill, who built a private rail company called the Great Northern Railway, and compare his enterprise with the crony railroads that were being built by the government at that time.
Well, this is a fantastic story, and my guess is it's hardly or maybe never taught in public schools, because it would be a very strong defense for free markets. And so we don't know about that. We know about the cronyism and the bad things that big corporations did at the end of the 19th century. The railroads were very much involved because they all got subsidies, free land and subsidies. And virtually they all went bankrupt. You know, they went bankrupt and then got more bailouts, except for one, the Great Northern Railroad. And he did it totally privately, bought up the land, devised a system, made a lot of money, and it combined a lot of railroads, both in Canada and United States. So it's a very, very good example of how transportation and infrastructure can be done privately, and yet nobody really wants to pay any attention to it, and they don't know much about this. But there are some good stories about Hill and the Great Northern Railroad that people ought to look it up and read about it, because it's a great defense when people say, oh, the private industry wouldn't do this. Well, guess what the government industry did with the railroads? Most people know, well, the railroads were bad people, and they were corrupt, but they were crony capitalists. It was the government's interference that caused so many problems then. And when there was no government involved in a railroad like the Great Northern, it worked miraculously. It was successful. It was profitable, and it was faster. It occurred much sooner and quicker than the government railroads did. So people just need to have the defense, because they still use this eternally. Oh, you libertarians, you're a bunch of crazy people to think that private industry would do so many things that would be helpful to the people. Well, they would do it not out of sacrifice, but because they wanted a good product and they wanted people to use your highways and your roads. But once you get the government involved, it becomes cronyism. And, of course, that's what we're involved in now. And so the politicians divvy up the loot. They collect the money. And if you're not in good steads with the administration or the Congress, then you don't get your money back for your highways. So that's the kind of system we have now. But that's the way Washington works. And then they say when it fails, what we need to do is bail them out and get them more money. And now what we're going to do is we're going to save the whole economy by having this revitalization of the infrastructure. We'll start off with $1 trillion. And my prediction is it won't work. It's not going to work. You need more free markets and limited government, and sound money is what we really need.
All right. Finally, Dr. Paul, we're going to talk about the seen and the unseen. Now, if the government does end up siphoning $1 trillion out of our pockets, they'll use it. They'll look busy while they're using it, inefficiently, of course, and that will be the seen. But there's also the unseen part. And what did Frederick Bastiat mean when he talked about the seen and the unseen?
He talks about an interesting story about somebody having his window broken, and all of a sudden the broken window energized the community. People had to make the glass and put the glass in, and it created jobs. And he said, isn't this wonderful? But after that was all done, they were back to square one. They just barely replaced the window. So even the Keynesians today have this silly argument. They said, when you really need jobs, what you do is you create money out of thin air. You get somebody to dig a hole that you don't need, and then you hire somebody else to fill in the hole, and that will stimulate the economy. But what is not seen? It's that energy and activity and money was taken out of productive efforts, and the people didn't make the decisions based on what they need and want and what is efficient. So it eliminates it all, turns it into a boondoggle, turns it into a political lobbying effort to get this money. So what is seen and unseen is very important. Nobody wants to ask. And the reason they get away with this is what is seen is so easy to sell. oh, I've just built this housing complex for the poor people, and they're going to have housing, and they're going to be happy forever. And they build that. But if they spend billions of dollars on that, where might it have been spent? Maybe on good jobs and better housing. And what happens to the government project? Usually run down and usually drug infested and all kinds of problems. And after 15 or 20 years, they get torn down. But you don't see what wasn't built. You always see immediately what was built. And they see this nice structure and say, didn't we do a lot of good? Aren't we providing services? We give food stamps to the poor people. Otherwise, they'd be starving in the street. Well, maybe the instead of might have been a good job or some type of job where they were a productive citizen contributing to the economy rather than playing this game of stealing from one group and giving it to another. And the theft today is very sophisticated. And, you know, theft for most people, I understand theft. If you want something and your neighbor has more than you do, you're not allowed to march in there with your gun and take what you want. People know that. And you could send the government with an IRS gun, and they do still do a lot of that. And they take the money and give it to the people who are demanding. And at other times, people get annoyed with that. So what they do is they go back to the old story of central banking, let the bank print the money, and then you don't know who the victims are. And the victims can't be counted, and they're not seen. And this is the process that's been used for so long. And that is why, I guess for 30 years or more, I've been talking about the Federal Reserve, because that is not only the engine of inflation, it's the engine of big government. It's the engine of the destruction of liberty. You can't finance this. Governments would be forced to live within its means. And this is not a Ron Paul idea. It's been understood for a long time. The founders clearly understood this. They understood what runaway inflation was all about with the continental dollar, the destruction of that currency. So that is why they said no silver, and only silver and gold, no paper money, and no central banking. And, of course, look at where we are today. We're at the end stages, though, of a system that's been pushed to its limits, especially since 1913, overtaxed and overinflated and overregulated, and a government and a country overly involved overseas, and a welfare system which has destroyed production. And it is a consequence of not understanding of who pays the bills. And ultimately, all this talk about, well, we have to help the poor and the middle class. And right now we know most of them don't even pay taxes, yet they are the victims. They are truly the victims. Even though the rich pay a lot of taxes, they so are super rich because of this program, because it's all in the crony capitalists, and then they go bankrupt, just like the railroads went bankrupt. So you bail out the super rich and they keep doing it over and over again. But the payment for this eventually ends up in the middle class and the poor, and the middle class, under these circumstances, eventually gets wiped out. And it's in sad shape right now. Just look at what's happening on our college campuses. A lot of middle class people going into debt to get a college degree. And look at the results. No jobs and such a mess. So they're not going to be very productive citizens. How many people in this country now have college degrees and can't get a job? How many people who have college degrees can't get a job and have moved back home? And I don't think it's because you say, well, they're just lazy. I think there's more to it than that. Many have been taught to be very dependent and expecting government to take care of them from cradle to grave and say, it's not my responsibility, it's the government's responsibility. But there are others who would be delighted to get a good job. But the circumstances we have, the monetary system, the financial system, and whether it's the infrastructure pretense, that if we just rebuild the infrastructure, it'll be such a great stimulus to the economy. And we don't have to worry about paying for it. Deficits don't matter. We have $20 trillion. What's the difference if it goes up to $21 trillion or $22 trillion? The world loves us. We are the exceptional nation. Nobody dare touch us. We got a powerful army, and we will be able to spread our exceptionalism, and people will always accept our dollar. That's where they're wrong. And one day we're going to wake up and find out there's been a rejection of this so-called American exceptionalism and a rejection of the dollar. And that is when we will have to reassess this whole mess. And one part of the reassessment and change that would be made would be to change this attitude about the infrastructure. Spending more money on the infrastructure is an easy way to solve the problem of our weak economy. That would be my suggestion. And Chris, I want to thank you very much today for being with us.
Thank you, Dr. Paul.
And I want to thank our viewers today for tuning in to the Mythbusters. And please come back to the Liberty Report soon.